Welcome to the Farcast, coming to you every week with insiders and experts to give you insight into the changing economic world. And now, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 11th day of March. This is the day that we were declared a pandemic a year ago. President Biden is going to address the nation tonight about where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. That's going to be fascinating to hear from the president tonight, the first time really that he's addressed the nation as president in his first 50 days in office. And we're thinking about all of those things too on the Farcast, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going as we try and filter through all of these things from Wall Street, Washington, and around the world. We turn to our friend Kenny Polcari here to talk about markets. It's been a wild ride the past couple of weeks. Volatility's increased. We've seen this shift out of the tech stocks. NASDAQ has been losing big days. The Dow has been gaining. S&P has been gaining. And then we have these shifts back and forth, which old market hands typically think this is the way a market makes a new level, whether you see lower highs and maybe lower lows would indicate we're heading lower. But looks like we're trying to establish a new trend in here to me. Let's find out what Kenny Polcari thinks. Kenny, good morning.
How are you, Michael? Nice to see you again.
It's great to see you, and thank you for being with us on the Farcast. You're one of our fan favorites. You know that. People write us notes about you, and they say, well, find out what Kenny thinks, Farr. So that's what we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to find out what Kenny thinks. You like this market? You don't like this market? We got a big shift going on away from tech, Kenny, or is this just sort of an intermediate-term pullback after a huge run?
No, well, you know, I think it's all the above. First of all, I definitely think it's a rotation. Look, value has way outperformed growth this year. Value as of last night's up 13% year-to-date. Growth is up 3% year-to-date. So we talked about how this shift 2021 was going to be a shift from growth to value as people kind of get used to the idea that, you know, we're going to get some inflationary pressures. We're going to see some rise in yields. And so therefore, there has been this shift going on. Now, that being said, yesterday, the CPI came out, right? I was talking about how I expected to see a surge in the CPI based on what had happened last month in the PPI, which showed this big surge in producer prices. We didn't get that yesterday, right? As far as the government's telling us, we still have zero inflation, no matter what anybody else thinks about the gas pump, about the price of beef, the price of chicken, the price of peas and corn and wheat.
That, price that of health care, the price of education, but the price right, of child means, care. We can go right. on with the list. It's all gone up.
Yeah, but that means not according to the government. They don't see anything in there that's raising any concern about anything. So they report yesterday that, you know, ex food and energy, the CPI ex food and energy was essentially flat, right? Came up at 0.1%. The expectation was plus two. It came in at plus 0.1%, which was better than expected, right? Because it's less than. And the market rallies, right? Because there's none of that inflationary concern that was building up when the producer price came out 2 weeks ago that caused the onset of all that drama. None of it flowed through to the CPI yesterday. And so look what they did. All in. And what was interesting yesterday was the Dow rallied hard, right? Up 460.
Hard, yeah.
Or 1.4. But there you go with the value and the cyclical names, right, in the Dow. The NASDAQ closed essentially flat, but it did have a huge move on Tuesday. So that
was 150 basis points difference in performance. Okay, and ladies and gentlemen, when I say that, this is something that, you know, market insiders are going to watch. The difference in performance, it was 1.5% difference where the Dow actually did 1.5% better than the NASDAQ in one day. And then you wake up in the morning and you look at the futures this morning, Kenny. NASDAQ futures are up 1.67%. The Dow futures are up 0.33%. That's a 1.33% gap of the NASDAQ going to outperform the Dow. So you had it underperform 150 basis points yesterday. It's going to shift back 133 basis points today. Do we care? And what are we learning from this?
Well, Tuesday it was way off base, right?
Completely the other way.
NASDAQ way outperformed. But what we're learning about this is certainly you can't pick tops and bottoms, and you can't just jump into one sector, right? You've got to be broadly diversified, and you've got to kind of play your cards right. I think all this volatility that we're seeing, especially now that it feels like we're exploding once again to the upside, is going to be met with pressure again. I think once again it's going to get ahead of itself, and I think we're going to start to see tomorrow we're going to get the PPI again, and we're going to see if it mimics what it said last month. And if it does, that's once again going to bring up that conversation. Look, PPI is edging higher. See, inflation is going to start to seep, whether it's April, whether it's May.
Hey, let's stop for a second. PPI, Kenny, is what?
The producer price index, which is the prices that producers pay.
Which measures what?
It measures the
prices
that
pay.
Yeah, to manufacture all these products. Now, listen, you can say right now that they're eating those higher costs. They're not going to eat them much longer, and that's my argument. I don't think they're eating them. I think they're starting to pass them on. It just hasn't shown up yet in the CPI data, as all the economists told us yesterday that it takes 2 or 3 months for that to happen. So that brings us.
Okay, so you got two arguments going on, Kenny. You've got the argument that was made by Jeremy Siegel this morning, where he says we're going to have a lot more inflation coming up. And then the old director of the White House, OMB, Peter Orszag, was on much earlier this morning. He is saying he was espousing the other theory out there that we're going to have inflation. It's going to be a rat through a snake kind of a thing coming up in the late summer and fall. And then we go back to this 2% GDP environment. Maybe it's not going to be till 2023 till we get back to 2% GDP. But basically, with the labor force where it is, without any growth and without any growth in productivity, 2% is where you're going to be. Who's going to be right on this?
I think both sides are right. I think we are going to see inflation. I do, though, think that that we're going to see stronger GDP. I think it's going to be higher than 2%, right? And I'm not an economist, but I get the
sense they're talking that, like 6-point-something percent this year, right?
It's
going to go back to 2%, but 6-point-something, almost 7% this year.
This year, right. This year will be very strong. I don't know. I haven't looked far enough out in 2022, but I wouldn't begin yet to opine on it because I'm not an economist. I don't look that far out. I'm just kind of looking, over the next 6 to 8 months, what do I see? And I do see not only the uptick in inflation, but I'm going to see the uptick in rates. And once again, the question is, the pace at which that uptick happens. If we get to 2% by December, that's 9 months out, the market will be fine because it will get a chance to adjust along the way.
No, we're going
to
be
2% in a month and a half, it's going to be a problem.
Well, when you say 2%, are you talking about the Treasury yield? Are you talking about the Treasury yield?
The 10-year Treasury yield, yes. Right now,
10-year Treasury yield. So it's back down to this 1.5% here, and Tepper has been all over CNBC here lately, where he said that, the fact that Japan is going to come up and begin borrowing because they're going to try and more manage their low rates and the gap between this and the 10-year, they're going to start buying treasuries. He thinks that puts a floor in. And then we got news this morning, just since you and I have been talking, that the ECB, the European Central Bank, commits to significantly higher bond purchases next quarter, and they keep rates unchanged. And Christine Lagarde says they're going to be buying U.S. bonds. Does that make Tepper right if we cap that 10-year yield at 1.5%? If it doesn't drift up, that sounds pretty dreamy for stocks, doesn't it?
Well, if that happens, it's very dreamy for stocks because what they will have succeeded in doing is capping rates at 1.5%. At 1.5%, there's no concern at all, and it'll be all in, right? Stocks will go higher. I did not see the ECB announcement. It doesn't surprise me because she, in fact, intimated that 2 weeks ago when the market started to get unnerved.
Yes.
She said that the recent rise in rates was unwarranted and that they were going to pay very close attention. So she was kind of hinting that they were going to get involved and they were going to start to do that. In fact, now today you said she just confirmed it. So maybe Tepper's right. Maybe I am wrong. Maybe they're going to hold rates at 1.5% and, the market's just going to continue to go higher, which is just another problem because once again, it gets stretched in valuation.
Well, that's another whole discussion about how stretched valuations actually are. If we see a 24% increase in earnings for the S&P 500 as our forecast for this year, and another, 20% for next year or some damn thing, it's a huge number, 15, 16, 17% next year on top of the 24% this year, you got fundamentals that are improving. So let's think about this, though, Kenny, for a second. If we have Japan buying U.S. treasuries and the ECB buying such that we put in a floor in the 10-year treasury and cap that yield at around that 1.5% level. Yep. We don't have a runaway 10-year. We keep that there. So that's a dreamy environment for stocks. Now, what we've been seeing is a risk-off trade out of the FANG stocks, out of the NASDAQ stocks, into the more value stocks.
Right.
That's been in anticipation of higher rates. If the rates get capped, do we see a swing back to the risk trade where people start buying the FANGs again? Or is this shift going to continue? What are you thinking?
No, I think if that scenario that you just played out where they're able to cap rates because everyone's going to stop buying U.S. Treasuries, I think then you see the shift move back. I don't think it does completely. I don't think it completely shifts, but I do think you'll see a shift back into the high growth things again because there'll be every reason to go all in on them, right?
So the techs keep falling. The techs stop basically from bleeding. And the rally becomes more broad-based, and we don't have this narrow leadership of six stocks anymore?
You know, I think the rally becomes broad-based, but I do think that, once again, you'll get the people that'll shift out of what is now considered kind of those value safety plays. You'll get people, once again, out on the risk curve.
We're going to have to define where the new risk curve is, I think. I mean, you know, you mentioned Apple before. You've been telling us about Apple and we needed to pay attention. Apple's still down.
Yeah.
And you think it continues to be a buy in here. Yeah.
Well, I do. And listen, and if the scenario you just outlined is true and they hold rates at 1.5, I think it's even more of a buy. Right. I think then it finds a floor as well, as do some of the other high growth names that got slammed. Right. I wouldn't necessarily say I wouldn't run right out right now and buy a Tesla or Zoom just because I wouldn't. I still think those ones have to go, but Apple is Apple, though. Apple, I own Apple. I'll probably never sell Apple. It'll just be a foundational holding that I just have.
Right. Your kids will get a nice stepped-up basis in your estate, and they'll say, "Dad, it was great to buy Apple. We're all richer and going to fly private now because Dad bought Apple." Okay. But let me ask you about the financials. Yeah. I mean, the financials had a fabulous day yesterday. Goldman was up 3.5%. J.P. Morgan up 2%. PNC up 2.34%. Even Truist was up a point. Does that continue? Is that going to be okay just because the yield curve is steeper now, even if we lock it at 1.5? Or does that take some of the froth out of banks?
No, I don't think it takes some of the froth out yet, only because I think we are going to see this global surge in economic activity. And I think any surge in economic activity is good for financials, right? And so therefore, I like JP Morgan, I like Bank of America. Those are the two that I own that I like. But I think that if the environment is what you and I just discussed and the economy gets better, even if they hold rates where they are, I think it's still a good story for banks.
A lot of moving pieces here. We're out of time. Can't believe it. Give me your final advice for Fred and Ethel, who keep looking at their portfolio and going, "Hey, you know what? This doesn't feel awful in spite of all the noise. My portfolio looks pretty good." What are you going to tell them?
Well, so I would say, listen, it does, and you're invested, so you shouldn't worry about that. If the market does better, you're going along with it. Don't chase stocks here. You can be patient. I still think there's volatility ahead. Not that I think there's going to be a crash, but I think there'll be pockets of opportunity to pick up names that you like at cheaper prices. But until that happens, ride the wave.
Kenny Polcari is our great friend and the voice of the New York Stock Exchange and explains the world of Wall Street to us so frequently here on the Farcast. Now in our fourth season, Kenny, we've been doing this for 4 years. You believe that?
I cannot believe it, 4 years. Wow.
I know it. It's amazing.
Good for you. Congratulations.
Hey, you've got Ron and Sana coming up later today or this week, don't you?
No, we did that yesterday. I did that yesterday. Yeah, yeah.
So is it still available?
We're not recording it yet. We're going to start recording it pretty soon. Right. Then they'll be available.
Who do you have next week?
Next week, I got Scott Shalady from, the Cal
guy. Perfect. Do you really?
Yeah, I got the Cal guy. I'm just going to put it out there now. But
he's got the cow coat, ladies and gentlemen. He's terrific. Kenny Polcari is terrific, too. Kenny, we'll talk to you again soon. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back with Dan Mahaffey. We're going to talk about the president's speech. We're going to talk about the new stimulus bill. And really, there's a new focus coming on China, and it's not going to be pretty. We're going to find out more in just 1 minute. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Welcome back to the Farcast, and now here's your host, Michael Farr.
We are back with Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, and probably most important and prestigious, especially for Dan, will be that he is the senior political analyst on the Farcast and has been for four seasons. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. Good as always to be here.
Very glad to have you here, Dan. Once again, not much going on in Washington other than $1.9 trillion more dollars surging into our economy if the president actually signs that, which I think he's going to do pretty quickly. He's addressing the nation tonight on his first 50 days in office and the anniversary of the coronavirus being declared a pandemic, the worldwide pandemic. That means actually a global pandemic is redundant. Pandemic does mean global. So anyway, we have that passing tonight. That's going to happen. And then we have renewed focus on things around the world. What do you make of what's going on in Washington? How are the Republicans handling this? How are the Democrats handling this? And we're going to filter down and drill down on what this is going to mean for your markets. So tell us, Dan, what are you seeing about Washington now?
Well, in Washington, as you note, we are noting that one-year anniversary, that passage of time, and over 500,000 dead, 10 million roughly jobs lost because of this. And now with the newest package, roughly $5.5 trillion in aid spending applied to this crisis. So the president and the Democrats in Congress are very pleased. They're proud of their accomplishments in a way in getting this latest bill passed. And what they want to do, and you can say it's celebratory, some could say spiking the football, they want to take credit for this. They see legislation that they've passed as highly popular. 60% of Republican voters support this, as a matter of fact. And they look back at the politics of this and the lessons learned from Obama, where they spent about $800, $850 billion at the time. Right. But they didn't take credit for it. They didn't take credit for, you know, other than you would see the little sign going up saying that this is a stimulus spending thing. They didn't really take credit for it. And combine that with, I think, hopeful news for the spring, the fact that the vaccination rate is picking up, the numbers are down. The administration, I think, it sees this as not only political success, but a way to take this and sustain some of this momentum into their next priorities.
Do you think this is something then that you might say that the Biden administration or the Democrats have learned from President Trump and his 4 years? I mean, and I think you're right, you're characterizing President Obama as probably understating or not taking credit for some of his achievements, a more humble approach. And then you had President Trump, who took credit for everyone's achievements. Including, you know, the fall of rain and the sunshine in the morning was all due to President Trump. And now President Trump really, I haven't seen a president ever play the media as well as President Trump. I don't think I saw any day, not one day in his 4-year term where he was not on the front page. Trump was not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, and New York Times, LA Times, etc. I mean, it was really remarkable. So are we in a new age of taking credit, and will that really work in politics?
Well, Look, I think we have to ask questions about the voters' memories because the next test will be 2022, and I know that's something we all have on our minds. But a lot of it also comes down to
Wait a minute. 18 months away, and the 2022 election is nothing the majority of Americans have on their minds. We in Washington have it on our minds, but
right.
most but people don't. They don't have about any like that
yet. But the economic picture will be interesting to see. Look, you see some of those projections that 6% GDP growth from this, global growth improving because of this, the amount of this, the impact of this projected to have the rate of childhood poverty in the United States over the next year.
The impact of this bill is going to have the child poverty rate in this country?
Correct. That's what the projections of this, a nonpartisan one, suggests, that the child...
That's the CPO credit, then.
Yeah, and this is going to be put in, and it's interesting to see, this is put in... It's a one-year credit for child assistance, but look, Senator Romney has actually proposed a larger permanent plan. So it's even shifting some of the dialogue on child credits, but that's just in the weeds there. But broader, look, for example, the American Airlines CEO, it's reported, has told 13,000 staff to tear up their furlough notices because this passed. They want to, again, take the real economic impact, you know, back to it's the economy, stupid. They right. want to get that impact and take credit for that, you know, as much of it is the bill, as much of it is the vaccination, as much of it is the weather improving. Take credit for all that. And it's the Biden administration strategy that we saw work for the Biden campaign. Stay out of the headlines until there is something to take credit for. And look, let the other side cover this the way they want to. I looked at a fascinating tool that Stanford has where you can track what's being said on cable news. Fox right. News talked more about Dr. Seuss than the deficit as this was coming through. So you wow. know where the minds of the Republican base is on this.
And didn't we hear one of the Fox News anchors suggest that the banning of Dr. Seuss books was probably the surest way to get President Trump running for president again and perhaps even get him elected again?
Well, I think that and how the administration and frankly, the Biden administration should be careful not to spike the football while this crisis on the southern border grows as well. That'll be the other thing that they need to keep their eye on. But look, those culture war issues aren't going away. But the bet that the Biden administration has is take credit for the situation improving.
It was very frustrating for Republicans to watch President Trump have one of the best economies ever, in spite of a pandemic and everything else. The economic data during the Trump years were terrific. The stock market was terrific. And the president kind of kept getting in the way of that message and derailing the really good news that they had. So, and I think it did get in the way of his reelection. You know, James Carville, the famous Democratic strategist who coined "It's the economy, stupid," said early on, I think correctly, he said, "I'm going to tell you right now, Joe Biden can't beat Donald Trump. Isn't going to do it. Can't do it. But." Listen to me now. Listen, Donald Trump can beat Donald Trump. Pay attention. He can beat him. So this is Trump's to screw up. That's what he said early on. Yeah. And I think with all that happened, a lot of the messaging that went away from that economic story that was so positive and other positive stories of the Trump administration, there were other great positive stories in that administration that actually, got lost in a lot of the other things on which the president tended to focus. So what are we going to hear from President Biden tonight? And then I want to ask you about China, another area of your expertise.
Well, I think President Biden is going to highlight the, I don't want to say highlight, I actually would say more reflect, you know, he's taken on that role of consoler in chief in many ways. And I think we'll start with some solemnity to recognize the impact of the pandemic and the loss, but also to take a hopeful tone on the reopening, the schools reopening, vaccination pace, numbers being down, the U.S. perhaps getting ahead of some of these variants, and then the work to be done and perhaps laying the stage for what comes next with infrastructure, investments in technology, things like that.
There seems to be one other point of agreement in Washington, and that is China. Both sides seem to have the long knives out for China. And I'm wondering, Dan, what you think we will see in terms of policy, what we're going to see in terms of tariffs that are already in place that haven't been budged. But Schumer pretty much sounds like he's leading the charge against China. What's the mood, and what actually can be done that hasn't been done?
Well, I think what you're seeing, I'll answer that first, that last part first. What you're seeing the administration focus on is at home, better institutionalizing the competition with China. And let's be clear as we go through this, competition does not necessarily mean conflict. But to better restructure at home for the competition with China, and then looking abroad to better cooperate and better partner with our important allies and partners on this competition with China as well. I think there's a lot of eyes focused. You know, we've had it was a two-hour call between Biden and Xi recently. That was the first dialogue between the two governments. Upcoming, there will be a meeting in Alaska that will take place between senior U.S. and Chinese officials. There's also going to be a greater emphasis on what Congress is doing. Some of these measures that are being proposed, there's the CHIPS Act, there's the Endless Frontiers Act. Those are focused on semiconductors, R&D. The Biden administration is doing a 100-day supply chain review focused on areas semiconductors, batteries, rare earth minerals, and pharmaceuticals. These are all things where they are gearing towards a long-term review of what our vulnerabilities are in those areas and how we reshape this relationship with China, because it's going to continue to have economic interdependence in many areas and a need to work together on climate change, international issues, but a lot more confrontation on technology, commerce. There's going to be more tension there, and tariffs are going to stay in place. They're going to continue to review those. But as part of that, they're trying to reach agreements with the Europeans. So as we're increasing the pressure on China on trade, they're wanting to find ways to ameliorate relations with Europe. So again, balancing with the rest of the world, but also still keeping that pressure on China.
More multilateral from this administration, certainly pressure on China. And what sounded more like calls for protectionism under President Trump sound more like we need, just in order to defend the country, we need to strengthen our supply chains on pharmaceuticals, for instance. There are certain pharmaceutical elements that are only produced in China. If we don't get them, we have a population at risk in terms of health. We're seeing the effects of the semiconductor shortage, semiconductor chip shortage throughout the automobile industry and elsewhere in this country that's affecting the supply chain, slowing production down. We've got to make sure that we can resource, whether it's we do it domestically or whether we have other partnerships and affiliations. I think China is going to be one of the bigger emerging stories around. And we're going to watch it and talk more about it with you next week. Final word for what you're watching this week, Dan?
Well, I think, again, continuing to see how the Biden administration goes ahead with this. And then finally, the future of the fundraising in the Republican Party, the struggle between Mitch McConnell, the RNC, and Donald Trump on who carries the ball ahead, and importantly, in raising money for 2022 candidates.
Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst on the Farcast, always bringing us insights and insider information into what's going on inside the Beltway. When we come back, another Inside the Beltway denizen, Heather Long, who's one of our favorite economists from the Washington Post, one of the brightest folks we get to talk to on the Farcast. We're going to try and figure out, will this inflation be temporary? What's going to happen in markets? And what does it mean now that this morning we've heard from Christine Lagarde and the European Central Bank that they're going to be buying bonds? The 10-year Treasury might be pegged in place, and Polcari says that'll be fabulous. All of that when we come back on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. If you would be interested in Michael Farr delivering a presentation at your upcoming event or seminar, we are booking now for 2020, and I'd be happy to work with you on potential dates. Please contact me, Harry Jennings, at hjennings@farrmiller.com, or give me a call at 202-530-5608. You can watch Michael's recent presentation at the University of Delaware's annual Economic Forecast on Facebook. Go to the Lerner College Facebook page, that's L-E-R-N-E-R, and scroll down to videos. Michael's presentation begins at about the 45-minute mark. And now, back to Michael Farr and the Farcast. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, a Farcast fan favorite, when we really need to understand what's going on in the world, and particularly the world of economics, we turn to our friend Heather Long, economics correspondent from the Washington Post, has one of the coolest backgrounds of any economist we talk to, in that she has her bachelor's degree in economics and English literature from Oxford University, master in financial economics and medieval literature. So Wellesley College, economics and English, and then Oxford University, financial economics and medieval literature. I'm not going to quote Chaucer again. I'm even going to stay away from Shakespeare, but I'm always so impressed, Heather, every time we get to talk to you.
I'm waiting for you to quote Beowulf next time.
that's a little tougher. I mean, I can do the Chaucer in Middle English, but who knows what to do with that Germanic Beowulf stuff. Bo, you know, as we have gone through COVID and shutdowns, a mead hall doesn't sound like a bad place to hang out, does it?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So if that's not too wonky for you on the literary side, ladies and gentlemen, we'll go ahead and turn to the world of markets and economics. Heather, give us your view of where we are in the economic recovery. Is it going to and how hot will it get? Are you worried about inflation? What happens to yields? Start wherever you like. There's a lot for us to cover this morning.
Yeah, for me, the biggest question is how quickly the jobs come back. It looks pretty obvious that it's going to be a very hot year for GDP. You know, you can pick your favorite number, but it'll probably rival the 1984 type of GDP growth. But the real question is, did the jobs come back as quickly this year? I was really surprised to see Treasury Secretary Yellen come out this week and say that after this stimulus passes, obviously she's been cheerleader for it, but she claimed that we could be back at full employment by next year, by 2022. So that's a pretty optimistic scenario, and now they have to hold to it. But looking at the latest jobs data this morning, we still have 20 million Americans on unemployment insurance, and it's been bouncing right around 20 million since Halloween. So there really hasn't been any improvement on the job front. Obviously, we do expect restaurants to reopen in the coming months, and we do expect hotels to reopen. But that's a lot of people to get back to work in a very short amount of time.
It really is. And yet we have seen interest rates start to go up. Folks are worried about inflation. And then you had David Tepper come out earlier this week and say you don't need to worry about inflation now that Japan is going to start buying our treasuries. It's going to put a floor or a cap, depending on whether you're talking about prices or yields on the 10-year treasury, of course. And then this morning we heard from Christine Lagarde, and the European Central Bank said that they're going to be buying treasuries. So if we do stay in this 1.5% range on treasuries and we get into 6% or so GDP growth this year, if that's somewhere around the number, does that become inflationary? Do we see a real spike in prices? Peter Orszag says we will, but it's going to be temporary. Jeremy Siegel, Professor Siegel, says It's not going to be temporary. That inflation's going to be with us to stay. And both of them say you don't have to worry about it. What say you, Heather?
I guess I am in the it's probably going to be a short-term phenomenon camp. And I do think the I have some trust in the Federal Reserve to be able to step in if needed, you know, kind of at this point next year. I guess the one thing you can probably hear it in my comments that I worry a lot about is where we are already seeing some inflation has been in food prices. And yes, one of the areas that ticked up in the latest report was rent. And so I do right now, sure, you know, nobody's buying the or renting the $2,000 to $4,000 a month apartments in Washington, D.C. or San Francisco or New York City. But I do think a lot about these low-income renters, and basically their lifestyle is experiencing some of the highest inflation of anyone right now, since so much of their budget goes to necessities. And that's where we're seeing a little bit of the spike. Oil prices obviously moving up, so those gas prices are moving up for them. So I'd say I'm not worried about inflation overall for the economy, but I am worried about it for these struggling people who are trying to get back on their feet in the next 6 months.
And for those who are trying to get back on their feet, this $1.9 trillion stimulus bill on top of a $900 billion, I can't believe I'm saying these numbers out loud, $900 billion stimulus bill, $2.8 trillion in stimulus in one quarter, essentially, has been approved, is going to be coming into the economy. Checks are going to be going out very quickly, according to the Biden administration. That should really ease a lot of pain out there, shouldn't it?
I hope so. And certainly the predictions, when you see these poverty numbers that are being predicted, I know you had a guest on earlier talking about child poverty maybe being cut in half. I focus on the overall number, and that is likely to go down by a third. So basically we would go from about 40 million Americans living below the poverty line right now to, you know, when we would be able to reduce that by 13 million, according to the Columbia University researchers who've been kind of at the forefront of this modeling during the pandemic. So you're right. There's a lot of reason to hope. And I will say a lot of this is going to come down to the Internal Revenue Service. Yes, they can probably get these checks out, but a big component of this aid and part of this package that often gets forgotten is this new child tax credit, or the revamped child tax credit. Yeah. And that onus of delivering that money, it's supposed to start in July and be sending families with lower income families with kids a $250 or $300 a month check for each child that they have. And that's a whole new program. That's basically turning the IRS into something like the Social Security system. And right now, the IRS is struggling to process tax returns at the same rate it was a year ago. So I find it hard to believe, and I want to be optimistic, but this is really going to be a challenge. Can big government step up right now?
Just mechanically, how they can actually do it. My dad, Heather, is 95 years old, and he actually called me and he said, "Hey, have you heard about this child tax credit?" And he said, "You know, I have four children." I said, "Dad, you have four children in, you know, 50s, 60s, Dad. I mean, they're not going to, why not? I've got four children. I want the child care tax credit. There's money coming my way." I said, "Yeah, well, we'll work on that, Dad." He was very excited. You know, but part of this comeback trade that you've talked about, too, that I think is very interesting for investors is going to be the comeback in that real estate market. You know, I know in Washington, D.C., we have had thousands of vacancies in apartments, particularly studio apartments, efficiency apartments, smaller one-bedroom apartments, where all of the younger new job people and graduate students have bolted and gone home to move in with mom and dad. But a reopening later this year and a prevalence of a vaccine, real estate should actually, at least in the rental market and multifamily market, should come back, shouldn't it?
Well, we hope so. I have my own little gauge on that. The first one-bedroom apartment I rented when I moved to D.C. in 2017, and in that particular building, it now is $200 a month less in rent. Instead of, I think I rented it for just over $2,000 a month, and now it's renting for $1,800, so, you know, about $1,800. So that's my own personal gauge to watch when that building, which is in you know, a pretty nice area in Washington, D.C., when they start ticking those prices back up to what I was paying 4 years ago.
Wow.
So,
you know, it's
so
hard for them in Washington, D.C. with rent control, too, to lower those prices, because when you lower the price, you reset the time bar and the clock resets lower, and it really prohibits the landlord from raising rents. So, Heather, as you look at the economy, are you convinced that we're out of the woods, or are you worried?
I'm a lot less worried, I would put it that way, given that the stimulus is now passed. And honestly, you have to give a lot of credit. The vaccine rollout is finally getting underway. I just did a survey of friends around the world to see how many people's parents, sort of folks over 60, have gotten the vaccine. And not just in the United States had most people, at least their parents, at least been able to get the first dose, but around the world, Romania, Dubai, India, a lot of people's parents were already able to get this vaccine. UK people had already gotten both vaccines who were over 60. So you're starting to see this. You know, there's still certain places that some of them, which surprised me, a friend in Luxembourg said they were struggling there. But in that sense, we've been all saying this for a year now, that the vaccine and the virus would dictate the economy. And it finally seems like we're starting to get the upper hand there. And frankly, you start to look at whatever measure you want. You start to look at those TSA, the daily airport security numbers are finally starting to come up from rock bottom. I've seen a lot of people have been watching the various public transit figures out of New York City. I mean, they're not skyrocketing back, but it finally seems like there is an uptick in use, even in things like this that have for a long, long time been depressed. So in that sense, with the weather improving across the country, it seems like things are primed for the consumer to be back in a big way in the service sector.
Does that worry you in terms of inflation? I know we're running out of time, but I still have a couple of three questions left.
I mean, it does. There's definitely, the question is it to the level that's truly worrisome, that truly causes alarm? And I don't know, I may eat these words. Right now, I don't see the case for alarm.
Okay, don't see the case for alarm. So my next two questions, what is worrying you? Is anything economically keeping you awake at night? And if you were Jay Powell, would you be doing anything different?
If I were Jay Powell, what keeps me awake at night is communication. They are about to enter one of the hardest phases this summer, just what you've been pestering me about. They're going to get pestered by reporters every time they, you know, so much as look outside.
Pestered? I've been pestering you? I thought that this was sort of intellectually curious pestering, I guess.
It is. Bad choice of words, perhaps, but they have to start signaling, right? Powell likes to signal at least 6 months in advance when there's a change in thinking at the Fed. And so that would put them probably around June, July, somewhere in there, that they're going to have to start signaling if they're going to take, not raise rates but necessarily in 2022, but even take off a little bit of their bond buying or scale back a little bit on their accommodation in 2022, they're going to have to start talking about that and how they do that without sparking another, you know, taper tantrum like scenario is going to be a big challenge for anybody.
You know, Jeff Lacker, the former president of the Richmond Federal Reserve Bank, was on with us a couple of weeks ago. And he said, you know, the one thing that the Fed really tries to do is not make the same mistake twice. And that December 2018 rate hike little phase there, they still feel burned from that. They remember the taper tantrum. Many of the current governors were Fed governors then. And so he thinks they're going to be very cautious there, for better or for worse. Okay, my final question here. As we go through the next 2 years, a number of economists have been telling me that they think, you know, whether it's probably not 2022, but perhaps in 2023, we begin to return to that 2% GDP growth. When you look at that old measure of hours worked plus productivity, we're right back to 2%. Does that make sense to you? Do you expect that, or do you think we can see some sort of higher rate of organic growth, going back to your first point, that might be driven by employment and wage gains?
Yeah, that's an interesting question to ponder. I don't know. I think the real question is probably 2024. You know, you could probably still see some residue in 2023 if things have been strong for 2 years. For 2021 and 2022 have been so high. You know, some of the forecasts are still pretty high, like 5% or 4.5% for 2022. So it'd be hard to maybe fall quite down to 2% for 2023. But is 2% still the long-term growth trajectory? I mean, that's certainly what the Congressional Budget Office still says. And I don't know. I think one of the biggest debates I've been having with people, the smartest people I know, is whether there really has been any sort of innovation during this pandemic period. You know, Zoom is fun, but it doesn't really feel like a true innovation. Is right. there really something that's lifted productivity to a new degree? And I don't think we've got the answer to that yet.
No, and we're going to watch that productivity number. We're going to be watching all of this. And when we continue to have questions, we turn to Heather Long for answers, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much, Heather, the economics correspondent from the Washington Post and one of the brightest people, most thoughtful people we ever get to talk to on the Farcast. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast. We will be back again next week. We're going to talk about, see what President Biden says tonight, see what happens as this next bill gets launched. And remember what Dan Mahaffey said about the new focus on China. We have bipartisan support for a very tough stance on China. The second largest economy in the world. What's that going to mean for us as an economy and for investors on Wall Street, all coming up next week and more. Thanks so much for being with us in Naples, Florida. I'm Michael Farr.
Thank you for joining us on this week's episode of the Farcast, and thanks to Michael's guests, Kenny Pulcari, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest Heather Long. We love hearing from you every week, and we try to respond to all of your notes and suggestions. You can reach us at hjennings@farmmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have and topics you'd like to hear us cover. The Farcast comes to you weekly and is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and is available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and all major podcast platforms. We would like to remind you that the Farcast podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered legal or financial advice. Statements, information, comments, views, and opinions expressed and provided in this podcast, including by speakers who are not employees or agents of Farr, Miller & Washington, are not necessarily those of Farr, Miller & Washington or any firm any of our guests may represent. Any mention of a specific security should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell, and please be aware that past performance is not a guide to the future performance of any security, index, fund, manager, or strategy. We strongly recommend you review with a financial professional before you make any investment decision. And if we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'll be happy to put any of our listeners in touch with one of our investment professionals for a complimentary review of your portfolio and your investment goals. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week. Go beyond the headlines each week with the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world.